Today is December the 2nd, 2020. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet. You can leave me a message with your questions or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. You should opt out of Amazon Sidewalk. Have you heard of Amazon Sidewalk? Probably not. But if you have an Amazon Echo or Ring camera, you should opt out of the service. What is Amazon Sidewalk? The feature was quietly announced late last year. It's sort of a secondary shared network for certain connected Amazon devices. The idea is it uses Echo and Ring devices as a bridge to extend connectivity over longer distances. So let's say your internet goes down and your outdoor Ring security camera is useless, but not an issue with Sidewalk. You can just tap into a neighbor's Echo or Ring device because, Sidewalk takes a small portion of your bandwidth that then gets lumped together with other Echo and Ring devices in your vicinity to create the separate network. In total, Amazon says that the monthly data it will borrow is capped at 500 megabytes, or roughly the equivalent of streaming 10 minutes of high-definition video. Amazon did not spell out what security and privacy precautions were taking to make sure that this secondary network wouldn't be easily exploited. Amazon says that as an Echo owner, I am donating a small portion of my internet bandwidth to provide a service to my neighbors. Amazon Sidewalk would be enabled by default on all supported Echo and Ring devices linked to my account. Unless you take the step to opt out, it is by default on. On Amazon Sidewalk FAQ, there's a lot more detail, including a comprehensive list of devices that can act as Sidewalk bridges, but not devices that are Sidewalk enabled. The FAQ also provides a link to a more detailed white paper on the privacy and security used by Sidewalk. Amazon says Sidewalk uses three layers of encryption, and you'll never know what other Sidewalk devices are connected to your devices. Well, that's what they say. I, like many others, are very skeptical. Last year, Gizmodo was able to map Amazon's home surveillance network, revealing the possible locations of tens of thousands of Ring cameras across 15 U.S. cities via the Neighbors app. Publications Vice and Gizmodo both found instances of hackers breaking into Ring cameras, ultimately leading to a class action lawsuit, or the fact that initially, Amazon did not explicitly state that in its privacy policy that humans may listen to voice recordings collected by Echo devices. Amazon white paper goes into great length about its privacy and security measures. Amazon may tell you that it's done everything in its power to make sure Sidewalk is private and secure. But there are talented hackers out there, and we all know they're out there, who, given enough time, would likely find a way to exploit a potentially gigantic secondary network that gives them access to a wide population of homes. And by the way, this network is not costing Amazon any money at all. It's us that buy their units, giving them the network. Obviously, the success of an Amazon Sidewalk will depend on how many people do not opt out. In the case of Amazon Sidewalk, you are not only trusting that this network that Amazon is building out isn't vulnerable, but also that users will stay current on relevant security patches, and that if risks are exposed by third-party security researchers, that Amazon will respond in a timely and transparent manner. You are essentially trusting Amazon. The easiest thing to do is to not buy into the Echo or Ring ecosystem. However, there are plenty of reasons why you might want a smart assistant, and an Echo in particular. Accessibility for disabled loved one is one of them. And when it comes to smart speakers, Amazon is providing you the option to opt out of Sidewalk, and you should absolutely take it. Microsoft Productivity Score Workplace Surveillance Feature. Microsoft rolled out its new Productivity Score feature, which lets bosses track how the employees use Microsoft's suite of tools. If that sounds like Big Brother is watching you, it sure does. Privacy experts are criticizing the company for promoting workplace surveillance. When Microsoft first announced the feature in October, the company billed it as a way to provide insights that transform how work gets done to employers. To do this, the tool gathers data on each employee's behavior across 73 metrics and presents a detailed breakdown to their bosses at the end of each month. These metrics include how often workers turn their cameras on during virtual meetings, how frequently they send emails, whether they regularly contribute to shared documents or group chats, and the number of days they use Microsoft tools such as Word, Excel, Skype, Outlook, or Teams in the last month, just to name a few. Microsoft lays out all the ways it monitors you through its Office suite and the company's own documentation, though admittedly you'll have to go digging through about a dozen web pages to find them. The workplace surveillance feature was released without fanfare on November the 17th. It is not a work monitoring tool, and that Microsoft has incorporated several security measures to demonstrate its commitment to privacy. For example, every employee's productivity score is aggregated over a 28-day period, and there are privacy controls available to anonymize that data or remove it completely. Of course, what Microsoft fails to mention is that only an administrator, such as your boss, can manage those controls in the first place, which is zero comfort for any employee justifiably concerned about potential invasion of privacy. Microsoft calling the feature an opt-in experience, even though workers aren't the ones who can decide whether or not to opt in. Productivity Score is an opt-in experience that gives IT administrators, that's the managers and the bosses, insights about technology and infrastructure usage. Insights are intended to help organizations make the most of their technology investments by addressing issues like long boot times, inefficient document collaboration, or poor network connectivity. Insights are shown in aggregate over a 28-day period and are provided at the user level so that an IT administrator can provide technical support and guidance. Privacy experts see this workplace surveillance repackage as a productivity optimization tool and one with metric scores in its design to be morally corrupt. Being under constant surveillance in the workplace is psychologically abusive. Having to worry about looking busy for the stats is the last thing we need to inflict on anyone right now. This workplace surveillance feature is problematic at many levels. While Microsoft offers employers the option to turn off employee monitoring, it's enabled by default when they first boot up Microsoft 365. Microsoft's new tool may even be illegal in some European Union countries, given the region's strict regulations on how companies can access user data. One way to crystallize how creepy this scheme is by imagining a person with a stopwatch and a clipboard sitting behind you, meticulously recording how long you spend on each task, compiling a dossier on everyone doing the same, then reporting the findings to management. Workplace surveillance has become a particularly prevalent concern this year with the pandemic pushing more and more people to work from home. In June, the research firm Gartner found that 16% of employees were using monitoring tools more frequently to track their workers' computer usage, internal communications, and engagement, among other data. And with coronavirus continuing to climb to record heights in the United States, experts expect the development and adoption of these tools to only ramp up further. Big Brother's watching.
Generally, when you come up with something that's a plus, that's a good thing, that's something that you wish you had thought of yourself, it has two edges. It has the good edge and it has the bad edge. What do I mean? It's something like this. I learned how to use the Moto G7. It updated to Android 10. I was very happy with that. I learned all the intricacies. I learned how to talk to it, how it would talk to me. One night, I went to sleep feeling very confident in my skills with the Moto G7. And I woke up in the morning, and a couple of things didn't seem right. When I got into my car, the map didn't go on. And before this happened, it was perfect. I'd get into the car, I'd plug in my phone, the map would go on, and everything was hunky-dory. Okay, that was changed. I didn't know it had changed, and I couldn't figure out what was wrong. But what I did do is I loaded Android Auto manually from my phone, and then everything was fine. That was curious, so I got out of my car, I closed it down, I got into my car, and again, the map did not work. I plugged in the phone, and the map should have worked immediately. I loaded Android Auto myself manually, and everything was fine. Okay, that's not a big deal. Really, how much work is it to load Android Auto? You press a button. But nobody had told me to press the button. Okay, not a problem. I pressed the button, Android Auto loaded. I told it to give me directions to where I had to go, and a little red car appeared on the screen. A little red car? I mean, come on. It was cute, but it also was covering some of the information I wanted. I then had to say, navigate to the nearest gas station, because the little red car was covering the little gas station, and I didn't know where it was. Again, not a big deal. This is what's called a pain in the back, a pain in the neck, a pain, yes, there too. During the night, somebody had decided that this would be a very nice thing to have in their car, so they, back at Android headquarters or at Moto G7 headquarters, or at the car company headquarters, someplace, somebody decided this was a very nice thing to have, and during the night, they changed the programming and sent it out to thousands, maybe millions of customers all across America, who got up in the morning, as I did, and suddenly didn't know how to use their car GPS. Wouldn't it have been nice if I had gotten a piece of email that said, tomorrow or tonight, we're going to download a change, and that change is going to do this, that, and the other thing? Don't surprise me with it. Maybe I was counting on something else to happen. It's just one of those really bizarre things, a change that you don't really know about. It might be a good change, it might be a bad change, it might be changing something you're depending on. Nevertheless, they made the change.
Upcoming is a most interesting auction. Apple One with the original box, signed by Steve Wozniak, is up for auction. An Apple One computer with its rare original box, signed by designer Steve Wozniak, will be auctioned by Boston-based RR Auction. The Apple One was originally conceived by Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak as a bare circuit board to be sold as a kit and completed by electronics hobbyists, the initial market being the Palo Alto Homebrew Computer Club. Wozniak alone designed the hardware, circuit board designs, and operating system for the computer, and the first demonstration of the Apple I at a computer club in July of 1976. Upon seeing interest among the membership, he and Jobs pooled their resources to have the boards produced. They originally hoped to sell 50 of them at $40 per board to recover the initial $1,000 outlay. However, seeking a larger audience, Steve Jobs approached Paul Terrell, owner of the Byte Shop in Mountain View, California, who was one of the first personal computer stores in the world. Terrell offered to buy 50 of his computers at a wholesale price of $500 to retail at $666.66. Boy, isn't that the sign of the devil. But only if they came fully assembled. With this request, Terrell aimed to elevate the computer from the domain of the hobbyist enthusiast to the realm of the mainstream consumer. Steve Jobs agreed to Terrell's deal and managed to secure favorable terms for financing the parts necessary to build 50 Apple I computers. He and Wozniak then spent 10 days putting together, soldering, and testing the Apple I units before delivering them to the Byte Shop. Thus, the Apple I was one of the first completely assembled personal computers which did not require soldering by the end user and simply worked out of the box with a few accessories that could be purchased from a local electronics store, such as the Datanetics keyboard, for example, was the recommended model for the Apple I and sold by the Byte Shop and elsewhere. Altogether, over a span of 10 months, Jobs and Wozniak produced about 200 Apple I computers and sold 175 of them. This particular Apple I computer was restored to its original operational state in September of this year by Apple I expert Corey Cohen. A comprehensive technical condition report prepared by Cohen is available to qualified bidders. He evaluates the current condition of the unit as 8 out of 10. Aside from the presence of exceptionally rare original shipping box, one of just a handful of known Apple I boards and box sets known today, the most remarkable aspect of this Apple I computer is that it is documented to be fully operational. The system was operated without fault for approximately 8 hours in a comprehensive test. Along with the documentation includes the original Apple I operation manual and original Apple cassette interface manual, which feature the original Apple Computer Company logo designed by the third Apple co-founder Ron Wayne on the covers. The operation manual features information on getting the system running, using the system monitor, and expanding the Apple system, and has a fold-out schematic of the Apple I computer. At center is a page headed 6502 Hex Monitor Listing, a famous program commonly known as the WAS monitor. Also includes a program from the 2005 UCLA event at which Wozniak signed the box, an image of the present owner with Wozniak and the box at the event, and a printout of the 1994 email from WAS about the Apple I. The early success of the Apple I in 1976 paved the way for the introduction of the Apple II in the spring of 1977. In Apple's 1980 IPO prospectus, the company described its progress. In April 1977, the company introduced the Apple II computer mainframe, which was similar to the Apple I, but incorporated additional circuitry and a keyboard, and was packaged in a plastic housing. In other words, the Apple II built upon the Apple I to become an even more capable, more consumer-ready machine. Between 1977 and 1980, on the sales of the Apple II and its peripherals, accessories, and software, Apple computers' yearly revenue grew from $774,000 to $118 million, making it one of the great growth stories of Silicon Valley. The Apple I is not only a marvel of early computing ingenuity, but the product that launched what is today one of the most valuable and successful companies in the world. What makes this particular Apple I even more valuable is that the collector had the foresight to present one of the extremely rare original boxes to Steve Wozniak and have the Apple I creator hold it in his hands one last time. Among the 25 items included is an Apple keyboard signed by Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, computers from the collection of software pioneer Roger Wagner, materials from the collection of Apple's first COO Del Yocam, and a rare musical cue sheet. Online for the Apple auction from RR Auction will begin December 10th and conclude December 17th. For those with the interest and, of course, the financial resources to go with it, more information is available from www.rrauction.com. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell on ageism in the workplace.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now is when we get down to business. Now is when I start talking about the world of the IT professional. And I have 30 years of experience. Most of the people that I work with have been around for 10, 15, sometimes 20 years in the industry. 30 years is a long time. And I'm going to be going for quite a while longer, too. And this is kind of a different world that I am slowly crossing over into, because it's very hard for people to look at me and say, oh, you'll pick up technology right away. And they see an older guy and they think, he doesn't know what he's talking about. Oh, yes, I do. I was a digital native. Digital native? Yes. A digital native is somebody who, but prior to their reaching the teen years, they already had experience with computers. I was a preteen when I had my first computer and my next computer as well. And I think maybe I'd have to really sit back. I might have had three computers before I hit my teens. So I'm a little bit different than most people my age. A lot of people my age, they look at a computer and they go, okay, I understand how the mouse works and I understand Microsoft Office, and they've stopped putting Microsoft Office on their resume. You know, you no longer have to put Microsoft Office on your resume, because if you don't know Microsoft Office, there's no way you'll survive in the workplace. But that's another story for another day altogether. So let's talk about this. I am coming up against a brick wall called ageism. I am coming up against something that, well, everybody is going to have to deal with at some point in time or another. IBM is under a class action lawsuit in regards to, and actually multiple class action lawsuits in regards to, yes, ageism. In regards to, yes, IT employees who lost their job because of discrimination for their age. I don't think that coronavirus is going to help us any either. When you start considering that 80% of the people who have passed away were over the age of 65. Yeah, that's right. 65. That starts to be kind of that magic number when it becomes very easy to, well, not survive. And that's unfortunate. And companies start looking at a lot of different things in regards to the health of their employees at that age. So how do we combat ageism? How do we, as employees, keep up with the young bucks, that's what I'll call them, even though, yeah, it's also it's all of the young people that are coming along, and they are very familiar with computers and familiar with technology. I'm quite well adept at all of this, but most people my age are not. So how do you keep up? One of the things I'm going to suggest is to start taking classes. But I don't want you to take classes in run-of-the-mill programs. I don't want you to dive into, I don't know, just pick up some obscure thing. Oh, I took a class in Photoshop. No, that's a fun class. I took a class in 3D rendering and 3D printing. No, that's a fun class. What I want you to think about is something called coding. And actually, there are many variations on this. It's a matter of processing data, processing the information that's moving through. And there are a number of different forms that this can take. One of the areas that's a specialty of mine is I love statistics. And I know the business statistics that they're looking for. I know the different metrics that they want to see. And I know how to derive those different numbers about how the company is doing, about how a department is doing, about how I'm doing. I know how to pull that out of a variety of systems. That's one of my special vertical specialties. We all need to have something that adds a unique value to us. So coding is one of those areas. Coding comes in a variety of formats. It's a matter of understanding how to create an algorithm to do X, Y, or Z, to get a result of A, B, or C. And look, you don't have to be a coder per se. You don't have to be a full-time computer nerd sitting in a corner writing up all kinds of various programs. But if you understand a little bit of code, if you understand something out there, some of the different coding languages, that puts you ahead, that puts you far beyond a lot of the people that are out there. It says that maybe you're not a digital native. Maybe you're not quite as adept with computers as some of the other people, but you have a specialty, you have a skill, and you're focused on learning how to provide information to the business, which is really what we need in the information age. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. How to speed up running Windows 10. Some of the Windows 10 services you can disable safely to speed up your system if they are not used. Windows 10 isn't as sluggish and bloated as some prior versions of Windows, but why tax your system running unnecessary services? There's a long list of Windows 10 services that most users don't need, so you can safely disable these unnecessary Windows 10 services. Windows services all have specific jobs. Some of these jobs are critical for your computer to work properly. If you disable a Windows service that is needed for the normal operation of your computer, you can get locked out of your machine, or you may have to undo what you've done. Always create a system restore point or system backup before making any changes. Disabling one of these recommended services to be disabled is not harmful. The print spooler. Do you have a printer? Do you ever use it? Well, I use a printer quite often, so this is always active, but many others have very little printing or none at all. Printers are becoming a niche item as we all transition to paperless documentation and use smartphone cameras to scan documents. If you don't use a printer, then you can safely disable the print spooler. This is a service that manages and queues print jobs. Without any print jobs to process, it just sits there, taking up RAM space and CPU time. Windows Image Acquisition. This is a service that waits until you press the button on your scanner and then manages the process of getting the image when it needs to go. This also affects the communication with digital cameras and video cameras that you connect directly to your computer. So be aware that if you need this function, don't turn it off. Then there's fax services. Unbelievably, there are actually plenty of businesses that still use fax machines. I don't use it, though. Fax usage is very niche, however, so it's almost certain that you don't need fax services on your computer. Bluetooth. It's safe to disable the Bluetooth service if you don't need it. It can be a precaution against Bluetooth attacks, too. These days, Bluetooth devices such as mice, game controllers, and headphones are common, so only a small number of users who never use Bluetooth should consider this. Windows Search is safe to disable and can have a noticeable effect on your performance, because it also disables the Windows Search Indexer, as most people do, however, do instant fast searches. Instant fast search performance is one of the best features of Windows 10. It's an option if you don't make much use of your Windows search or your CPU is really slow. Go ahead and disable it to see if it boosts performance. Windows error reporting. Windows sends an error report back to Microsoft when things go wrong. Microsoft uses this information to fix problems in future updates. Some people have a privacy issue with this and choose not to send any reports. If you don't want to send error reports to Microsoft, you can go beyond selecting Don't Send Every Time and disable the entire service. Then there's Remote Desktop. There are three remote desktop services listed in Windows 10. These three services work together to make remote control of your computer possible. If you don't use the remote desktop functionality of Windows, then you can disable all three of these services. However, keep in mind that Microsoft support often uses remote desktop technology to help fix issues you might be experiencing. Remote support won't work if you disable these services. But remote desktop technology can also be a serious security issue and is often used in fake support scams. So disabling these services can also help improve the security of your computer. Then there's Touch Keyboard and Handwriting Panel Service. Windows 10 is now fully compatible with both touch screens and handwriting recognition, but most desktop and laptop systems don't have that hardware. Disable the service if you don't use a touch keyboard or a pen. There are several more services that you can stop, but it is strongly recommended against messing with the Windows services that you're unsure about. Always research a given Windows service before you disable it. Hopefully this will speed up Windows 10 for you.
I got myself a new telephone operating company. I left Verizon. I've been with Verizon since the first day that cell phones were commercially available. And I had two misunderstandings with them. One, I paid for but could not get visual voicemail. Visual voicemail is a clever thing that they came up with where a person comes in and leaves on the telephone a message for you, and you have to listen to the message whenever you get a chance. But suppose all day you were in a meeting and you can't listen to the messages. Wouldn't it be nice if you could read the messages? Well, that's just what visual voicemail does. It transcribes the voicemail into a written text and you can read it. It cost extra. I paid extra. It didn't work. I got hold of Verizon tech support. They walked me through a number of changes. They said there was a problem at their end with my phone or my end with their system. I don't know what. But after about a week of back and forth, it worked. This was in September, September 2nd, actually. Well, about a month ago, it stopped working. It was in the beginning, very beginning of November. So I called up Verizon and I said, it's not working. And they said, that's strange. And they started going through the whole thing with me again. And they finally said, now it's working. But it only worked sometimes. It worked perfectly when it felt like working perfectly. But the rest of the time, it didn't work at all. The other thing that bothered me about Verizon is there are a lot of phone companies out there. There's T-Mobile, there's Sprint, there's AT&T. But the most expensive of all was Verizon. And they claimed that they were the most expensive because not only did they have the best, biggest, and finest network, but they had the best thorough tech support. Well, by now I was getting tired of their tech support, and I was also getting tired of the $230 a month my two telephones and one modem were costing me. So I started looking around, and I found the company Visible, V-I-S-I-B-L-E, which is fully and completely and totally owned by Verizon and runs on the Verizon network. No, not with 5G, just the Verizon 4G, what is it called, Hike, LHI, LH, whatever, doesn't matter. The difference is that they would not only give me a telephone, but it would be an unlimited telephone. I could use it for as many texts, as many voicemail messages, as many telephone calls as I wanted. It was really cool. I knew in advance what it was going to cost me every month, no matter what I did that month. It wasn't a question of carrying over as Verizon did. It was just a flat rate. Oh, incidentally, did I mention it's a flat rate of $40 per line per month? Not 200, not 100, 40 bucks. So I switched over to that. It's good, but it's not perfect because it doesn't have things like voicemail. But there are third parties out there that have voicemail.
A 2019 online security survey by Google identified that 65% of people use the same password for multiple or all accounts. Spotify is currently the number one music service on all platforms, and these include not only iPhone and Android, but also CarPlay and Android Auto. According to information shared by the company itself in late October, Spotify now has 320 million monthly active users and no less than 144 million subscribers paying for premium access to its contents. But this doesn't necessarily mean that Spotify is also the most secure service on the planet, and research conducted by VPN Mentor reveals how hackers managed to break into thousands of accounts using a rather simple technique. It's called credential stuffing. What is credential stuffing and how is it used against Spotify? First and foremost, security researchers explain that malicious actors didn't launch a complex operation against Spotify users, but actually relied on a method called credential stuffing. This hacking approach allows them to use databases of exposed usernames and passwords, very often from other breaches, and try the credentials on a new target. The method works more often than you imagine, especially because a worrying number of users continue to stick with the same usernames and passwords for multiple online services. The research team came across an Elasticsearch database that included no less than 380 million records. And while its origins are unknown, it is believed the credentials were obtained from other attacks. The 72-gigabyte database was hosted on an unsecure server and included account usernames and passwords verified on Spotify, email addresses, and countries of residence. Personally identified information has also been exposed, the analysis reveals, after the malicious actors likely obtained access to more than 300,000 accounts. The exposed database could be used in many criminal schemes, not just by the fraudsters who built it, but also by malicious hackers who found the database. Any of these parties could use the data exposed to identify Spotify users through their social media accounts and more. And with this information, criminals could pursue several activities to defraud and hack Spotify users. We have made hacking easier as crackers just break into databases where there is huge volume of account passwords. They then have a 66% chance of success in hacking accounts using the same password. A word to the wise. Use a different password for each online account, but that raises a question. How does one remember and update the information when needed when you have so many accounts? And by the way, how will the executor for your state be able to have the information readily available when you're no longer available and they need access to your information?
Samsung misleading advertisements. Samsung needs another public advertising agency that doesn't mislead, or they should put new people in their product planning department. I have over the years made many purchases of Samsung products, and when all things are equal, I judge differentiation of products with the added factors of fit and finish or build quality, reliability, and importantly, the reputation of the company. Over this holiday sales promotion period, I received many manufacturers' email extolling their products. What caught my attention was the Samsung 500GB T7 Touch Portable SSD. What the heck is a Touch Portable SSD? I know that an external SSD unit is often referred to as a portable solid-state drive, but what does touch have to do with any of its specifications? The Samsung literature also says the T7 Touch offers quick performance with little downtime with read and write speeds. But to say quick performance and a little downtime is not what I expect from an external solid-state drive. The inference is I will experience downtime with this unit while in use. I've also been looking to purchase a 500GB PCI Express non-volatile memory M.2 unit. I was perplexed that Samsung was offering their Series SSD 860 EVO unit, which met all my specifications, but with a 3-bit MLC? Now, let's get back to basic technical terms. SLC stands for 1-bit level cell, MLC stands for 2-bit level cell, TLC stands for 3-bit level cell, and QLC stands for 4-bit level cell. For the same capacity in a solid-state drive, the number of writes for the drive decreases with the increase of number of bits in each cell. And this is logical. When the cell unit limit is reached, you lose all the bits in the cell. Calling it a 3-bit MLC is a bit deceiving. This type of advertising stains the fine reputation of Samsung that took years to build. In researching the use of the term 3-bit MLC, it technically should be 3-bit TLC. It was misused in a technical magazine publication, and manufacturers seem to have latched onto its use. There are people who are responsible for writing product reviews for the affiliated publication, but it's not realistic to expect them to have expertise knowledge of everything they get to review. So if there's anything written by reviewers that are over the top, I generally don't get excited, and people reading the reviews tend to normalize the overall ratings with good and bad reviews. Hey, Samsung, you can do a better job. Presenting All Hands on Tech with Marty Winston on Benchware. He reviews more than 300 products each year, and tonight's report is about lots of the tools he's tried.
You may not know about the News Tips Bulletin. It's my 4-decade-old weekly publication. It goes to a very select subscriber base, just other journalists, and only a couple of thousand of them. There are reviews in each issue, a total of more than 300 products each year. Our next several reports here will share some of the scope and highlights among those products. That starts tonight with a Benchware report covering a lot of the workbench tools that got reviewed. A few days ago, our old pal Benjamin Rockwell asked which tool brands pass through here. In no particular order, Klein Tools, Works, Bosch, Rockwell, Skill, Ego, Zircon, Triplet, Diablo, Southwire, Caltest, Channelock, Wellington Tool, and MixQuick came to mind. Klein Tool sends a new product just about every week. They've sent a broad variety of pliers and wire cutters, hawkbill insulation cutters, trapezoidal utility blade insulation cutters, work knives, gloves, protective eyewear, remote read thermometers, contact thermometers, and lots of electrical testers. There have been pocket screwdrivers, ratcheting screwdrivers, nesting multifunction screw and nut drivers, right-angle driver kits with bits, and a few kits of miniature drivers, some with miniature bit sets that work on those crazy little security fasteners with donut-shaped head recesses. They sent a massive pry tool called Grizzly Bar, I love it, and work lights and flashlights and fans and bore cameras and thermal imagers and laser levels. It's wickedly rare to see the displays of Klein Tools at Home Depot and see anything there that's both interesting and not already here. It's all very well built and extremely useful. Diablo sent things that are especially useful in cutting, including three kinds of hole saws, reciprocating saw blades, and specialized drill bits. Southwire, that's the Romex people, also sent hole makers plus test instruments, insulation cutting knives, and strippers and test gear. Works, that's W-O-R-X, sent a lot of saws, drills, vacuums, blowers, drivers, and yard gear. Rockwell sent some interesting drill drivers. They're capable performers, very nicely built. Zircon is best known for its stud finders, only many of their models can detect more than just wooden studs. They can spot metal, electricity, and several kinds of different density materials that might be waiting on the hidden side of a wallboard. Impressive gear. They also pulled themselves away from walls to come out with one of the most practical leak detectors we've seen. Like many, this has a battery inside and a couple of conductors outside, so water between those conductors will set things off. Like others, when this one detects a leak, it beeps. But this one beeps SOS in Morse code and flashes LEDs, and if it's a bad leak, the whole thing floats. So now Zircon is both a drywall and a wet floor detector brand. Skill, that's SKIL, isn't just about saws anymore. They have some very impressive cordless drills and drivers, sanders, reciprocating saws, and more. And the cordless blower we got from their sister brand, EGO, E-G-O, is a force to be reckoned with outdoors. So is their snow blower. Bosch is doing amazing things with lasers. Their laser distance finder is a faster way to get measurements than any measuring tape, and it's dead-on accurate. For those of you who pay attention to our sensor coverage, yes, that is a LiDAR-based instrument using the time of flight of a beam of laser light to do its work. But the even more amazing Bosch products are self-leveling laser line casters. Any of the models can project a horizontal line, a level horizontal line, which is great when you're trying to line up a ceiling or flooring or something along the wall. They can also project vertical lines, righteously perpendicular lines that let you square up vertical elements like studs or door frames. Some of them do even more, looking like the grid lines of a powered-down holodeck. Fascinating, useful, time-saving, and error-dodging tech. Both red and green laser line caster models are available, really, for visibility reasons. But let's just pretend it's a holiday thing, okay? Thanks, Bosch. Caltest sent some of their different test lead sets. These are accessories to things you may already have, like bench power supplies or handheld digital multimeters. Those are the two we got in. Speaking of multimeters, we got a bunch of them from Triplett. That's spelled with two T's at the tail. T-R-I-P-L-E-T-T. They sent some interesting non-contact voltage detectors, some with extra features. Any of them good for telling you whether there's a live power feed at an outlet or on a wire. They have an arsenal of different tone and probe tester sets that let you cheat at needle in a haystack when you're looking for one wire in a bundle. Now, these are mostly for network wiring, but one of the newest kits is even good for live power wiring. There's a tester that tells you how long a wire you're looking at, making it easier to determine if that's the length to the end or to a break you haven't yet discovered. Their USB tester is a great way to figure out how much power ports can really deliver and how much your devices really do want to pull from those ports. Triplett is one of the oldest brands in test gear. They made the very first multimeter way back when, and they still offer some of the most usable stuff at very user-friendly prices. Several of these brands sent non-contact infrared thermometers, many of which use one or more laser dots, or in one case, an actual circle to show you exactly where it's taking its temperature reading. And a few of the brands sent work lights or fans, which is entirely relevant to the places where their tools are most likely to be used. Yes, that's a lot of brands. Want to hear that list one more time? Klein Tools, Works, Bosch, Rockwell, Skill, EGO, Zircon, Triplett, Diablo, Southwire, Caltest, Channel Lock, Wellington Tool, and MixQuick. Oh, you noticed a couple that you've never heard about before. Yep, Wellington Tool and MixQuick. MixQuick has one of the most fun tools we've seen. Well, probably more accessory than tool. You use it with a reciprocal saw, where it replaces the usual blade. Up the shank, it has a little floor and a holder frame with a strap. That's for strapping in your can of spray paint or whatever else wants to be vigorously shaken before you use it. Oh yeah, it gets it shaken. And you most definitely do not want to try using it with a can of carbonated beverage. But when you use it as you should, with paint or whatever, You get a very thorough mixing. That means the contents get used as intended. You get full use of all the coverage the can's able to deliver. Nothing left over. That's MixQuick, M-I-X-K-W-I-K. If you want to rig something up to try using it to make a milkshake as well, well, that's up to you. Just don't be surprised if it comes out butter. The other especially noteworthy tool is the one from Wellington Tool called Restorer. What you're about to hear is the full text of its News Tips Bulletin Review, which ran in late August. We don't remember ever seeing a power tool quite like the Wellington Tool Restorer, which makes it slightly more difficult to explain. This model, WR351K1, has a 4-inch wide drum and comes in a kit that includes three sanding rollers, 46, 60, and 120 grit. The driving drum is in the belly of the beast. This is a heavy, two-handed tool, almost 6 pounds. Its weight a deliberate part of its functionality. With a broad choice of rollers, it has many ways to claw rust and tough stuff off of surfaces, or smooth them, or polish them using many materials, from bristles to abrasives, wires to flaps, brushes to fabrics. Its no-load motor speed varies from 1,000 to 3,200 RPM under thumb wheel control, and its tail port lets you connect a vacuum for the inevitable dust collection. Bottom line, Wellington Tool's innovative Restorer has the power and agility to hit the front of the line when clearing, smoothing, or polishing because it has the muscle to really hustle through its work. That was the review. Just FYI, that same issue also had reviews of the triplet USB bug, the USB-C travel dock from Otherworld Computing, the Klein Tool's 100-pound capacity canvas bucket, a 6-foot leather dog lead from Galco, and 4 varieties of Popcorn Indiana products, aged white cheddar, black and white drizzle, sweet and salty kettle, and movie theater butter popcorn. It's true, our reviews span a lot of categories. Next time, we're still clustering reports based on this year's editorial product reviews, and our category is photon emitters. Yeah, lighting products. Mostly ones that our house ended up using. Join us for an illuminating report. We'll leave a light on for you.
Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Most of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For updated information, visit the website of the computer club. The Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on holiday tech gift ideas. Thursday, December the 3rd. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom video conferencing. Their website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has their general meeting on Friday, December the 4th. Meeting time starts at 8 p.m. and they meet via Jitsi Meet. The website is acgnj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club has their meeting on Thursday, December the 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and there will be a presentation on Is Electromagnetic Spectrum Altering Your DNA? The teleconferencing is via Zoom, and the website is nyacc.org. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on Are Your Bits Flipped? Thursday, December the 10th. Meeting time starts at 6:45 p.m., via Zoom teleconferencing. The website is bcug.com. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, December the 11th. Meeting time starts at 8 p.m., and there'll be a virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of this program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups.
I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.